Y'all, this interview with Vanessa Vakaria, who you may know online as the Math Guru, was so much fun. We talked about everything from math anxiety, grading practices, and the importance of broadening our view of what math actually is. And unsurprisingly, Vanessa did a little math therapy on me, which I should have expected considering her podcast and her brand new book are called Math Therapy. We recorded this interview some time ago, and with the busyness of the last several months, I am just now getting our conversation out into the world. In the interview, you'll hear Vanessa mention some ideas from her new book, and the great news is you do not have to wait for it to be released because it is now available for purchase. I'll link all of that information down below. But I am not going to make you wait any longer. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Vanessa. Vanessa, welcome to the show. I am so glad to have you here.
I'm so pumped. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, it has. So I met you for the first time in DC at the NCTM conference. And I was like, oh my gosh, kindred spirit. Like, it was just so fun to get to meet you. I was so bummed I didn't get to come to your session. I'd already promised somebody else. Big mistake on my part. I should have been there, but I will get to see you in July at two different conferences.
Yeah, that's how these things go. We have already always promised somebody else. So I know. As soon as I met you, I felt the same way. I was like, oh my God. Okay, shout out Robert Kaplinsky for this little soulmate matchmaking happening right now. Yes, for sure. It was amazing meeting you too.
Yeah, he's the ultimate match. I was about to say math maker. He's a great math maker, but he's the ultimate matchmaker. Mm. One of the things that I absolutely love about you is you are just like totally unapologetic in who you are. And you speak your mind so beautifully, so clearly. And it's just like so many times I'm like, yes, yes, yes. So I'm going to start off with asking you, what is something controversial that you believe about math or about teaching math?
I'd say the most controversial thing I believe about math actually is that I believe that everyone can build a better relationship with math. That has gotten me into a lot of hot water. So I'd say that's actually the most controversial thing. The most controversial thing I believe is that everybody can build a better relationship with math. And that is a hot, spicy topic right now, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So that's so interesting because when I tell people, when people are like, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, well, I work in the math education space. Like I eat, breathe, sleep math. They're like, oh my gosh, I could never. That sounds dreadful. Like, how did we get to this place where we speak about math this way and that the most controversial thing that you believe about math is the fact that everybody is capable of being great at math? Like, how do you think we got to this place?
I'm just going to rephrase what you just said and say that I did not say that. I said, I'm dying. I said that everyone can build a better relationship with math, and I stick to that wording very specifically. Okay. Not that I don't believe that many people can be great at math, but I specifically believe that everyone can build a better relationship with it. And how did we get to this spot? I mean, that is a whole can of worms. And I've really come to think lately, A, for self-preservation and also just the type of energy I want to put into the world. I really actually would like to say that I think that most people are well-intentioned. So I'm going to give you an example. I got an email from somebody the other day who works with kids with special needs. And she was like, what you are saying about math is so damaging. It is so damaging that you're saying that every single child can get better at math. And so at first I was like, what? Like, this is crazy. Like, what? But she went on to say, I work with kids with special needs. And I believe her number, I'm in Ontario, her number was something like, only 2% of kids who need IEPs, okay, who need accommodations in Ontario are getting them because the system is so backlogged. That means that if you're going around saying, hey, everyone can get better at math and these kids do not have the supports they need, it can be damaging because they're like, well, I'm supposed to be able to get better at math and I just can't. That must be on me. Whereas really it's like the system's letting them down. What do you know what I mean? So like when I started hearing that, I was like, listen, I think we're agreeing on the same thing, but I don't think it's fair to say, well, let's stop telling kids that they can build better relationships with math just because the system's letting them down. I still want them to know that they can do that and that they are being let down. But my point being is that I really do think most people in the educational space and in general really want to see kids succeed at math. They really do. And we just have different opinions on how to get there. So like, I think there's that. I think there's resistance to change. I think there are people who are successful now that think that the way they got successful is the only way. Like, I think there's a whole mishmash, but I would like to think that most of us are on the same side here and we just don't know how to get there.
Yeah. And I also think there's a misunderstanding of what math is. Like, when we talk about having a better relationship with math or getting better, whatever you want to say, like, we all have to be in agreement around like what we're talking about. Like, what is math? I saw a video on TikTok that you did and you were talking about, I think you called it like math adjacent skills. Do you know which video I'm talking about? And you were talking about So like even that is considered part of math. And so I think we just, when we have such a narrow view of what math is, then we're arguing things, but we're not even really arguing about the same thing.
Well, I think that's such a great way of putting it. I think that's it, is that, and that's why I'm being such a stickler when you're like, you said anyone can be great at math. I'm like, wait, hold on. Math, once we broaden the definition, and not broaden the definition as in we're just trying to dumb it down. Broadening the definition means seeing math for what it truly is. Math is a way to solve problems. It's a way to find creative solutions. Things that are mathematical include patterning, spotting trends, being the person who's like, why is everyone wearing Uggs all of a sudden? Finding the perfect solution to fix a fight between your friends, like putting together furniture, reading maps, solving complex equations, doing algebra, arithmetic. Like, there are so many things in there. But the truth is, when we say the word math, I believe that everyone jumps to classroom math. So then when we think of classroom math and we're adults, especially adults who are not teachers, if you're an adult and you're thinking of classroom math, you're thinking about what you were doing in the classroom. What you were doing in the classroom was you were learning formulas, you were memorizing things, you were getting the right answer, and that's what you were getting validated for. So yes, if I was going to sit here and say anyone can be amazing at that, I would be lying. That's not true.
Right.
But can anybody develop a better relationship with and develop new math skills and contribute to finding creative solutions to the problems on this planet? Absolutely yes, and I stand by it. But as what you said, we're talking about apples and oranges. We're talking about two different things because we're not defining math in the same way.
Yeah, yeah. I talked to Chase Orton and he said something really good. He was like, and actually, goodness, I'm the worst at like citing people or whatever. I always butcher like their words. So Chase, feel free to come back and fix what I said. But basically he was talking about the difference between like math class and math. And so when we're talking about math class, the way that we typically learned, you know, just the algorithms and the, you know, following all the steps and all of that. I know for a lot of people my age, we came out of math class with a lot of math trauma. And so, and granted, it's not exclusive to my age, but just this generation, we came out of math class with a lot of math trauma. And then we become educators and we go into teaching math, but we still carry a little bit of that math trauma. And so you talk a lot about healing math trauma with students. Do you have any thoughts about where to start to heal math trauma as a teacher? Because it's probably really hard to teach math if you have math trauma yourself.
Yeah, it's funny. Okay, I just, like, not to be like, oh my God, I'm so smart, but I just started reading. I want everyone to know this. I just started reading The Myth of Normal by Gabor Mate. Do you know that book?
No, I've never heard of it.
Okay, so it's all about, okay, The Myth of Normal, Trauma, Illness, and Healing in a Toxic Culture. I just, like, put it on yesterday. I was like, oh yeah, sounds interesting. I've actually already handed in the first draft to my book. Okay. So like it's there, it's gone. I start listening to this and within two sentences, I'm like, oh my God, like I need to like revise everything. And what he says, which I think is really interesting. And just because we're talking about math trauma and some people might be like trauma, like, okay, what are we doing here? The reason I bring up this book is what he said in it is, he's like, when we think of trauma, we think of these like giant events, right? That like, you know, an earthquake, like really horrible stuff happening. And that is big T trauma. But when we're talking about stuff like this, like math trauma, we're often talking about what's known as little T trauma. And then the reason I bring up this book is because he says you would actually be really hard pressed to find somebody who has not experienced at least one little T trauma in their life. Like it's something like neglect from a parent, being told you're not a math person, being told people who look like you don't normally do math, like being, you know, reprimanded consistently instead of ever told that you're doing well, being told that you're gifted can serve as a math trauma down the line because you think that your, you know, intelligence is innate. There's so many little tiny things. And what he says in the book is really the first step actually is for us to take a step back to be like, it's totally normal if we have had an experience that has created a teeny little injury within us. It, you know, like it's okay to be like, hold on a second. Are there things that have happened in my life that may have led to the math identity I have formed now? So if you're a teacher who's like, I've always felt a bit nervous around math. Like I always get nervous when I get up to the board. I don't want to make a mistake in front of the kids. Like when, you know, whatever, when someone, the bill comes at dinner, I don't want to be the one to like figure out what the tip is. Like it just makes me nervous. Totally cool. Why don't we take a minute to think about where that might have started? You know, like why is that? I find myself like take math out of the picture. I find myself a lot in life trying to understand where my reactions come from. Because the truth is that when you have these little T traumas built up, like we can stick to math here, you form a set of reactions to them. They become like trigger responses. They are almost instinctive. You don't think about them. So for example, like you're about to go do a question in front of the class and you just, your body reacts, right? You start like getting a little anxious. You start panicking a bit. Your heart is racing and you're just used to that now. You're like, oh, that's my math anxiety. But it came from somewhere. So the first step, which was your question, and now I've gone on a tangent. The first step is to actually reflect on where your reactions and feelings around math may have come from. And it can be such an interesting, rewarding journey to be like, when's the first time I even remember feeling like this about math? Or is there a time I can remember feeling different about math? And to start like piecing together the puzzle of your relationship with math from there.
That's all very interesting. I really like the distinction that you made of like the big T trauma and the little T trauma, because I think that, you know, even for teachers who went through and they were good at math class, we can still have those like little T trauma experiences that impact the way that we teach and interact with students. I would say for me, I was not somebody who had like a big T trauma experience, but I think I still, even as an adult, like I'm the person who will pull out a calculator to tip, knowing good and well that I can do the math. Like I have strategies to do it. But for me, I have this pressure of like, oh, you work with math, so you're great. And because of that pressure of like, there's this standard that you have to have, it makes me panic in pressure moments. And I was the same way as a teacher as well, because I'm supposed to be like the best at math. That so it's just interesting. Like, I don't know that I could pinpoint like a specific moment there, but it's like there's so much emotion and experience and just life that impacts how we interact with math. And so I really like that point that you said about like reflecting on that. Like that's the first place to start.
Well, and I'll even add to it, like, because I think the category of little T trauma is so like rich and wide and broad beyond what we can imagine. Like even as a woman, for example, okay, there is, have you heard of stereotype threat?
No.
Okay. So stereotype threat is a specific phenomenon where somebody from a group develops anxiety around something because they're scared of fulfilling a stereotype. So I would go as far as to say like many women, I know I definitely have this where like I am so nervous all the time that I'm going to reinforce the idea that women are bad at math, that I feel that extra pressure to like perform. And they did a bunch of studies where they showed where they made gender really salient to women before taking a math test. Like women had to read a paragraph either about walking a dog or about being like being feminine, being a woman, la, 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 la. And every time they underperformed when they were made to read that gender salient paragraph. So like, it's really interesting. A lot of folks in, you know, who are on the margins when it comes to math, like from marginalized populations or from populations that are often overlooked in the math space, there is that stereotype threat that I would argue is a major cause of little T trauma. It's just the knowledge that you are being underestimated and people are already doubting you the second you walk in the room just from the way you look. Like, that's why I'm like, it is pretty hard to think that most people do not have not experienced one or more little t traumas in math in one way or another, just because it can be simply due to lack of representation, for example, right?
Right. Yeah. Goodness, this is like therapy for me. I'm like, can we like turn off the camera and just unpack this a little bit more? Because I'm like, I really need to work through this. That will be for after. Yeah, but I really appreciate that. I've never heard that. And I totally can see that in my own life. And I'm sure in the lives of the teachers who are watching, and even for students as well. You know, it's interesting, something like as I've explored, you know, math trauma and math anxiety and all of that, it's sometimes I think that there are teachers and students who hold math trauma, or they are anxious around math, but it's not easy to necessarily identify in order to support them. How do you identify that a student has math anxiety when you're working with them?
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting. It's a really interesting question, because I was actually talking to a neighbor of mine who's like an old retired teacher. You know, he actually used to teach, in his words, at-risk youth remedial, like job skills. Okay. So he was saying to me, and I just thought it was like actually a really wise statement. He said, if you listen and observe, students will always tell you how they're feeling. And he didn't mean like with their words. He meant like if you are observant and like really with eyes wide open, going into a situation, wanting to read the situation, like you will see what you need to see. And so I think something that's really important when we're talking about like being anxious around math is knowing the ways that math anxiety can present itself. Yes, it can be a student being like, I hate math, I feel nervous around math. But it can also look like things that might be less traditionally associated with anxiety. For example, absenteeism, constant lateness, boredom, distraction, fidgeting, disrupting other kids in the room because they don't want to stay on task, saying they hate math, saying they don't need math, saying math isn't for them, saying like, oh, they're just better at other things, saying they don't want to try. Like in most situations where a student doesn't feel comfortable around their relationship with math, there are going to be signs where you can tell. And that's why I'm like, none of this, nothing I've mentioned, by the way, has anything to do with grades. Because so many of my own students who are getting 90s, you know, like they are the most math anxious students, right? Like they're the ones who are panicking, who want a perfect score, who feel their only sense of worth is derived from their GPA. So like none of this has to do with performance or grades. It really has to do with feeling. So like I would really have my eye out for statements that might not even seem related to math, right? But that might seem related to like effort, being overwhelmed, being stressed, being tired, feeling sick, those kinds of things.
Yeah. I think it's important. Like, I love what you said. Like, if you're really listening and observant, like kids will tell you. But I think that oftentimes like it doesn't present in the way that we would expect it to look. And so just being really curious about, okay, why did they say that? Like, why did they approach it in that way? And it's really interesting, as you were talking about all of that, I was like, I think sometimes when we have all of those feelings, it's easier to just be like, oh, I'm not a math person. Like, let's make jokes about it. I don't really care. It's kind of like from a place of self-preservation. And, you know, going back to the very first question we talked about, like, I think that is part of the reason of like how we've gotten to this place where we wear like, I'm not a math person as a badge of honor. Like, it's just such common language. And I wonder if it's coming from that like place of just, it's easier to say that than to be like, I have a really bad relationship with math.
I think it's probably like a bit of both of like, I don't know that we know to even start thinking about it that way. Like the idea of talking about our relationship with math is very new. Like, again, like we weren't talking about that kind of stuff in the classroom 10 years ago. Right. So I think for sure it is, you know, when someone's like, I can't even balance a checkbook, like, oh, I always sucked at math. I think it is a self-preservation thing. I'm trying to think of like, you know, it's kind of those things we say about ourselves because we're too scared to actually try out what the other option might be. Right? This idea of, but what if I really cared and I couldn't do it? It's better to just say, I don't care. I don't need it. Some people can do it. Some people can't. I can't. Not a big deal. Than to really sit down and be like, wait, was I robbed of the opportunity to be good at something and develop a skill that would have made me more confident? Like, who wants to think about that? That's depressing, right? Like,
yeah.
And also, we've really normalized this idea that some people can and some people can't. We've always placed the blame on the student. It's the student's fault if they can't do math. So we have all of these adults and kids running around thinking that, you know, it's them. And it's like, no, hi, it's not you. Like, you're not the problem. It's not you.
Right.
Like, to quote Taylor Swift, right? Like, it's not you. But I think the biggest consequence to this culture is that we have all of these people running around feeling innately less than. They feel that they were born at a deficit. They feel there is something wrong with them. And we have not had the courage to say to everyone, hey, this is not your fault. It's the fault of so many other people and systems in place, but it's not yours. And until we have the courage to do that, we're always going to have this dichotomy between those who can and those who can't.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. It's fascinating when you look at the research and then also just look at experiences, how when a student feels like they are dumb in math class, how that impacts their belief about themselves as a learner in all other aspects of school and life. And it's such a heavy place to be in, like that puts a lot of responsibility on educators and teachers who are, you know, creating those math spaces, because we want students to feel very empowered and have this sense of belief in themselves that they can learn. So there's a lot of pressure there, but I also think it's a beautiful place to be that it's like, oh, when we shift the blame from the student to like us and the people who are creating the systems and the curriculum and all of that, then we can have change. If we place the blame on the student, it's like, well, they can't do it. Like, nothing I can do about it. But when we have such a huge impact on how they learn and the space that we create for them to learn, that's like really empowering to me. I'm like, okay, like I can change this.
I think this is probably just such a little microcosm of all of the issues in the world where it's like, hey, if we just blame the individual, we absolve ourselves and our systems of any responsibility. We can just keep on doing things. The truth is change is scary. Change is hard, right? Like change costs money, like all of these things, right? I think that's probably where people get their backs up so often, right? Is like, people feel like they're being blamed. Like me and you are talking about this and kind of saying like, it's not their fault. It's like our fault. Okay, who is us? Who's that? Like, is it mine and your faults? Like, probably not. Like, I don't even have a person to point to of whose fault it is. It's just the way we've all sort of let things go. And now it's our responsibility to peel it back and say, how can we all contribute to doing better? But I think we all just get so defensive, you know, and like feel this blame. But if at least hopefully we can all just agree, like, okay, we don't know who's like, let's stop pointing fingers, but at least let's stop pointing fingers at our students. Like that, those are the first place where we should remove our finger pointing.
Right. Well, and I heard something that was so good. It was like, it doesn't really matter whose fault it is. Like, it's now our problem to make progress on, you know? So it's like, we may not be able to figure out who to blame, but it's our problem that we get to make change towards. Like no individual teacher can completely fix everything on their own, but like we can impact the students that we have, the interactions we have with parents, you know, you have a social media presence. I post online. Like we can impact like our circles, even though it wasn't our fault. Like we didn't create this. We talked about, you know, the fact that it is maybe not our fault, but it is now our problem that we get to, you know, make change towards. And so I would love to hear from you because you have, now correct me if I'm wrong. So you own like a tutoring like place, like a boutique tutoring, I don't know.
Yeah.
House. What do you call it? It's like the cutest little place. Company, organization. I was like, what word am I looking for here?
I own a tutoring studio in Toronto, so it's a brick and mortar studio.
Very good.
I call it a studio because it's like studio vibes. Like it's kind of like, you know, pink velvet and incense and like math. And I don't like to call it a center because it's like a studio.
Right. Okay. Center. That's or studio. That's the word I was looking for. I was like, studio. What do I call this? Anyways, studio. And I would imagine, and you can totally correct me if I'm wrong, I would imagine that a lot of the students who come to you are probably coming to you maybe because they're struggling or maybe they want, there's something that they're doing that they want to do better. Like, so do you see that a lot of the people or a lot of the students that come to you have math anxiety or math trauma?
Yes. Yes. I would say the number one, like, so I've been in business now for 13 years. Wow. And I will tell you for sure, I want to throw out a number, but I'd be making it up, but well over half, let's say, well over, like I want to say 80%, okay, mm-hmm. of our students have some form of math anxiety. Like you would think tutoring, oh, great, I'm going to help students who are struggling with their marks. Honestly, that's what tutoring is normally for. It's like people being like, you know, like Johnny needs a higher mark and so he's going to get some help. No, it is mostly parents sending us kids being like, they feel like crap about their math abilities. They have no confidence. They're crying over their math homework. Often very high achieving kids, as I said, getting high grades, being like, but they just don't think they're good enough. They're panicking all the time. So really at the root, whether you're a remedial student, whether you're, you know, like enriched or whatever all the like labels are that I don't even believe right. in, but like whether you're there because you're almost like whether you're coming to see us because you need to pass a course or you're seeing us because you want to get into this top college, both from at all ends of the spectrum, math anxiety is for sure involved. In every yeah. case, it'll be like part of what we do when we tutor. We're not just helping you learn the content in the way that the teacher wants you to show it to them. Like, that's not what we're doing. Yes, we're working on math skills, but we're working on what I said before, those math adjacent skills, like getting you to feel more comfortable with taking risks and putting yourself out yeah. there, being okay with making a mistake. Like, first of all, skills that are going to be fulfilling and beneficial far beyond the math classroom, but skills that are holding most of our students back when it comes to the hard math skills. Because yeah. in any math problem, you have to be willing to take a risk. You can know as much math and as many formulas and have all your times tables memorized, but if you're too scared to take a risk, you're not going to be able to answer many math questions, period.
Yeah. So I completely agree. It's interesting. Have you ever read Hidden Potential by Adam Grant? It's his new book.
No, but it keeps getting recommended to me. Should I?
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I'm only like a chapter in. So I was talking to Peter Liljedahl when he came on the show, and there was this study in the beginning of the book, and it was talking about how the determining factor of like income was based, it was like, they saw a trend that it was like based on the kindergarten teacher. And it was not because the kindergarten teacher taught them like these basic reading skills and math skills, and that carried them with them all throughout middle school, high school, and beyond. It was because the strength of the kindergarten teacher, it was those math adjacent skills that you were referring to. It was, and he lists like five or six things. It was like the willingness to take risks, being able to collaborate. It was like persevering and solving problems or challenges. Like it was those characteristics that a really good kindergarten teacher built up or set the foundation for in those kindergartners that impacted them for the rest of their education careers into their like actual career. And I just thought that was fascinating and also like so cool that as math teachers, we get to develop all of that for students. It was just so eye-opening.
It's so cool. It is so cool. I think it is like one of the privileges and opportunities we have as math educators is to provide our students with these skills that are going to take them far beyond our classroom walls and far beyond math. I think one of the issues is how do we really show our students that those skills are valuable when we're often not providing them with grades for those skills. And right. very unfortunately, students have been taught that external validation via grades is the only way to be worth something in the classroom. So I think there's just like yeah. a bit of a disconnect of like, We know those skills are valuable. Kids think the only valuable thing that shows them value are grades, and we don't yet have a really great way to grade those skills. So how do we bring, like, we're the, you know, the pieces are there, but how do we put the puzzle together?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a really good thought, because, you know, my first instinct is like, but we don't really want to grade those skills. Like, totally. I don't love grades just in general. But you're right that though, that like, if we are grading things, we are grading the things that aren't really
there.
Like, we're grading the thing. We're putting an emphasis on the things that we don't really want to be putting the emphasis on.
There's all these parts of the conversation that are controversial, but like, they don't need to be. Like, here's the reality. Grades exist right now in this moment in time in most schools. That's it. Whether you agree with grading or not is not what we are discussing here. All I'm saying is kids have been taught that grades are the only purpose of going into math class. Like, they've really been taught that. So like, either, so again, this is like you said, it doesn't matter whose fault it is. It's our problem to solve. Would we like them to keep thinking that grades are the reason to be in math class? If your answer is yes, okay, then what are you grading and how are you showing them that that thing you're grading is valuable? And then you have to recognize, if you're not grading something and you've taught them the only reason to be in math class is to get a grade, if you're not grading something, that thing has lost value. They're not paying attention. So that's like arm one of the tree diagram. Arm two, kids think the only reason they're in math class is to get a grade. You don't like grading anymore. Okay, great. Awesome. We've decided we don't want grading. So now what are you going to do? That's a whole other section. So like, I'm saying is, regardless of how you personally feel about a grading practice, our students think that that's the only reason they're in math class. So what are we going to do about it? Like, how are we going to show these kids that these skills that we all find valuable, risk-taking, problem-solving, coming up with creative solutions, how are you going to give those skills value in your math class in a way that students feel and believe that those skills are valuable?
Yeah. And I think there's also something to remember is that there are a lot of ways that we communicate what we value to students. Grades is one of those ways. And yes, that's a very heavy way that we do that. But we also show kids what we value based on our actions as well. So like, if we are working through a problem and one kid gets it and then we move on to the next one, we're showing that we value right answers and speed right there. So it's like, how can we may not be able to change the grading practice at our school. Okay, that's the case. Well, then how can we focus all of the other ways that we communicate what we value to students? How can we make sure that that is highlighting the things we truly value? Does that make sense?
Oh my God, it could not make more sense. And like, again, I just wrote a whole chapter in my book about this and I'm obsessed with this because it's like, yes, that is it. But I also think this, like, the other piece I'm just going to like throw on is like, as adults, okay, I want you to think about this. If you're listening to this, like Brittany, I want you to think about this. How do you feel valued? Like in life, what do you look for to tell yourself, hey, I've done a good job? Like, I'm asking you this question. What gives you, tell me what you look for. What are your signs? That's my question. What is this? What are your signs that tell you, you know what, Brittany, like, yeah, I'm proud of myself. What do you look for?
Man, that's really hard because like, I think the easy like go-to response is like external validation, like somebody telling you, but I don't actually like thrive in that way. Like, yeah, I don't know. I'm probably the worst person to ask this because I think for me, I set the standard for myself. And if I feel that I've met that standard, then I can be really proud no matter how many times people outside of me tell me that. I don't know. I could make it easy on you and just say,
I don't know if, because now I'm like, okay, so you feel proud of yourself. You've done something great. And then someone comes along on the internet and comments on one of your posts and is like, you don't know anything. You have no experience. How do you feel? You don't care?
Oh, that will tear me down. Yes. That will. But it's, so the negative, I will take that in and like take it all on. But the positive, I'm just like, oh, she's nice. Like that.
Okay.
And I don't internalize it to be like, oh my gosh, I should be really proud. I did a great job.
Okay. So I think this is interesting. And then like, obviously I'm going to interview you. So I'm going to grill you on this when you're on my podcast. I will just say that I would, first of all, that's amazing. And I'd love to know where you learned to do that. And while I do that to an extent, I know I rely heavily on external validation. And most people I know do. Like most adults I know are like, we're looking around who, like, how much money are people making? What jobs? What are their families like? What are their relationships like? Like, how many likes are they getting on Instagram? Like, I'd say we mostly live in a world where external validation is king. And I would argue that we learned that in the classroom, because we really learned that a teacher telling you you did a good job and mostly via grading were the things to look for to know that you are good at something and that you're worth something. So, like,
yeah,
all that to say that even if you can't change your grading practice at your school, what you're saying, there are other ways to show kids what you find valuable, are so important, because you are going to have to overcome this huge hurdle, which is that the number one way they've been taught to feel pride in their work is through external validation from the adults in the room, mostly via grading. So how are you going to combat that? And then also, I would love to have more skills to be able to internally validate, so I'm not so heavily reliant on what, like, people on the internet say about me. I would love that. I would love if someone had taught me that in grade six, you know? So, like, all that to say, like, you are doing your kids a huge service by finding ways to teach them to internally validate in your classroom, because that's going to help them to grow into adults who are unapologetic and who do things to change the world, regardless of what trolls on the internet, like, think about them. Wow, this is getting really personal. You can tell where my head is at right now.
Well, it's so funny that you took what I said and you're like, oh my gosh, that's so great, because it actually does not feel great at all. But again, that's a conversation for another day. Like,
why?
And no way was I saying that, like, oh, I'm so healthy. Oh, because the bar is constantly moving. Like, I have set this bar and I can never reach.
Oh my God. But see, so, now I'm like, where did your bar come from?
Yeah, I think that the bar is probably external. The bar that I set for myself is probably external. Mm. I should be capable of doing this, but no matter how much, like, anybody says, like, good job, this was great, this was so helpful, if I have not met the bar that I've set, there's no amount of validation that's going to make me feel good. And the problem is that bar is always moving. So I'm in my own therapy for perfectionism right now. So
we need to do math therapy.
We do. I told you. I was like, some of the things that you were saying before we got on at the beginning of this, I was like, oh, I really need to work through that.
Well, no, because I'm just like, now I'm thinking about the bar thing, about how you said the bar I set for myself is external, right? Because it must to some degree have to do with comparison and looking for, right? In a way, you're probably like, okay, I should be able to achieve this based on something I saw someone do, or I don't know.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm like, oh, if this is possible, like, what actually is so fascinating is I saw a tweet of yours and you said something about, like, what was the report card remark that, that still sticks with you? And it was something about meeting your potential. And do you know what I'm talking about? Okay. So that was the thing that has always been said to me my entire life. Like, she has so much potential. She has so much potential. And so for me now, like, as a student, as an athlete, like, and I still hear that. And so for me, it's that, like, potential. So, like, maybe there is not even a bar. Like, maybe the bar is so high and it doesn't exist and I don't even know where it's at. So there's never any opportunity to meet the bar, because this, what is potential? Like,
what is potential?
I don't know. Right. That's why I need to read Hidden Potential. I need to get past the first chapter and keep reading and figure it out.
It
was always said as, like, a compliment, though.
Of course it's always said as a compliment.
People say it as a compliment.
People say gifted as a compliment, though. Mm-hmm. And that can be so much research has come out from kids who have been labeled as gifted, being like, it was one of the most damaging things someone ever said to me. Like, again, I don't think people are going around doing malintentioned stuff, but, like, you have to imagine, like, again, we live in a society where it's always about getting more. And that's what concerns me with the potential comment, is, like, when you make a comment like that, when you're setting a bar with an infinite ceiling, who do you know in life that is satisfied with what they have? Do you know a single person who's like, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah.
And you have to be so careful with that mentality, because there's a difference between ambition and this bottomless pit of never enough. Those are two very different things.
You said, like, the way that you just worded that, you said a bar with an infinite ceiling. Like, that is what it feels like. That is so, like, I need to sit with that. I'm going to write that down and be like, okay, I'm going to bring this to my therapist. We're going to have a conversation about this.
Please do.
So, okay.
It has math in it. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to bring us back to math. Although I think that all of this is so relevant.
This is about math.
It is. It is. And we are working with, like, yes, everything that I talk about is math, but we are working with people. Like, we are working with multiple children. And, like, we have such an opportunity to, I just think it's important for us to analyze and self-reflect and just constantly think about, like, are the messages that we're sending, are they helpful or could they be harmful? And that's not to, like, shame or judge any teacher. Like, there's been so many things that I've said, even to my own kids as well, where I'm like, oh, that could cause little T trauma one day down the road. But I think the more that we can, like, look back on it, like, these are important conversations because, you know, now hearing how much has come out with me about, like, I think potential has struggled with me, that will never be a thing that I say to a student or a student's parent or anything to be like, you have so much potential in math, you know, because that's just been harmful for me. So anyways, with all of that being said, coming back to the reason I asked you like 20 minutes ago about your tutoring studio was because I wanted to know, you know, you've got a lot of students who come to you and they have math trauma. What do you do to help heal that?
So, I mean, there's definitely not a quick answer. I think, like, the process is maybe more, like, I think for me, my main thing is to observe, like I said earlier, like, I want students to, A, first know that whatever they're feeling, it doesn't matter what it is, you know, like Gabor Mate said in the title of this book, The Myth of Normal, like, there's no normal. Any way they feel about math or in general is completely fine. So that's number one. And number two, to try to really help them feel seen and heard in their emotions, like, to really understand what's going on. So I ask a lot of questions. That's always kind of my inroad when I'm talking to a student, is to just ask a ton of questions that they've likely never been asked before and that they're not considering, right? So that's number one, to make sure they're validated in those feelings, to know that those feelings are perfectly okay. And then just as importantly, to make sure that they know that any anxiety around math is absolutely not linked to ability, period. Like, math anxiety and math ability have nothing to do with, I mean, they have a lot to do with one another, but what, you know, it, math ability is not determined by math anxiety and vice versa. Yeah. So, like, I mean, I have so many stories about my own math anxiety, and I've, you know, like, I once got the answer to 4 minus 3 wrong on national television. I promise you, I know that answer. It was just an immense amount of pressure. So, like, just to make sure they know that what they're feeling is completely chill vibes, it's totally okay, and that has nothing to do with their ability. And that normally is the first step to taking a lot of pressure off. And then you can really start making some inroads. So, yeah, if I was going to distill that down to a process, I'd say ask questions, listen, observe, validate, and make sure they know that their feelings around math have nothing to do with their ability.
Yeah. Do you work with a lot of older students, like middle school, high school, or do you have some elementary students in there as well?
We have both. Yeah, it's K-12.
I'd be so interested in, like, it sounds like you do a little bit of educating them on math anxiety or, like, their brains and, like, how they're responding to things, because I would think that it would be really empowering for them to hear, like, this is why you're feeling this way. Like, you, like, I think just making them more aware of their emotions so that they can then separate that from the ability.
I think we're, like, in a good place where I'm noticing that a lot of my younger students are saying that they're talking about emotions in their classrooms. And I think it's one of the biggest things we can do for our kids. Like, I never learned about emotions or what they felt like. Like, it took me until last year to, like, not cry when I got angry, but to actually realize I was angry and experience a mad reaction instead of a sad reaction. Like, seriously, like, we really didn't learn that stuff. And so I think it's really important because emotions are so powerful. And one thing I tell students is, in the way that math anxiety and ability are related, the way that matters is this. When you're anxious, like I'm not going to go into the science of it because I'm not a scientist and whatever, but like in general, just imagine you're anxious. You're being chased by a tiger. A tiger is trying to maul your face off and someone is yelling at you, okay, but just like what's 4 minus 3? Like I know you know the answer. Do you think a tiger is now about to bite your face off? Do you think you can answer that question?
Right.
You probably can't. No. Is it because you don't know the answer? Is it because you don't have the ability to do that calculation? No, it's because you're busy. Your brain energy is being occupied by this tiger literally about to mow down on your face. So like that's basically what's happening is your anxiety response in your brain is being completely distracted. Your resources are being wasted. Not wasted. Your brain resources are being used on managing that anxiety and they cannot now take in mathematical information. So in that way, I think it can be really reassuring to kids to say, hey, listen, it totally makes sense. If you're feeling stressed and nervous about math, it has nothing to do with your ability, but it's preventing you from actually learning stuff because your brain's like busy dealing with it. So if we can actually do some stuff together to help you just kind of feel a little bit better, it's going to open your brain's resources up to being able to digest math a little more easily. I think it's really important to explain that to students. And to explain that a lot of people feel this exact same thing and that it's not permanent. It's not some permanent affliction.
Yeah. That visual with the tiger is so powerful. And I was bringing it back to my comment about tipping and how tipping brings me so much. There's so much pressure there. And I was like, but with that visual, then you can say like, okay, let me work to unbusy my brain right now. Like, what is the thing that's like, you know, taking my brain's resources. And like for me in a tipping situation, it's like the person's standing right there and they're going to think I'm done because I can't do this quickly. And like the fact, like all of this stuff. And it's like, okay, if I can like get better about working through that, then I can just use all the strategies that I have and tip.
Totally. But, and also to recognize it's not that easy, right? It's not like you just say, oh, brain, stop being anxious, right? Like,
no, it takes time. I'm sure.
It takes time. And it's like, all of these, like, I think about how I've learned to like build a better relationship with my own anxiety. And it's like, it has been 8 years since I started this journey and I'm still doing it. Like the number of strategies I have of mindfulness things, of meditations, of breathing, of grounding, like, so no, you're not going to just say to a student, oh, well, don't worry. Just don't be anxious about it. And then you can learn math. It's our job to recognize that this is a real issue and that we need to provide our students with, just like you're showing your students strategies on how to multiply a number, we need to give them strategies on what to do when their anxious brain pops up during math. Like both of those strategies are important.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I could literally talk to you for another like 10 hours about all of the things. I cannot wait to see you in July. It is going to be fantastic. We're going to be together. We are going to be together at Camped, so the math conference in Texas, and then also get your teach on in Florida. So we will have all of the hours for us to talk about all of this.
Oh my God, I'm so excited.
I know. I cannot wait. But I know that the teachers are, I mean, they probably all know who you are. But if they don't, where can they find you online?
You can find me anywhere online at The Math Guru. So TheMathGuru on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, whatever. That's the best place to find me. Find me there, but please don't troll me. Thank you.
Yes. Also listen to her podcast, Math Therapy.
Yeah.
And we didn't even talk about your book.
Okay. Brittany will be a guest on Math Therapy. You're going to be on my podcast. I will. Soon, so we're going to just like do part two of this. Okay.
I will. I'm very excited. Okay. Before we go though, you have to tell us about the book because you're writing a book. I don't know when it's going to be released, but just give me the rundown. What's it going to be about?
Okay. So the book is Math Therapy. The book is a book for math educators it's 5 steps to helping your students heal their math trauma and build a better relationship with math. So I'm going to be going through a 5-step process you can use in the classroom, if you're a coach, whatever, in order to help every single student build a better relationship with math. So it's something I've been like doing for years and years and years, and I finally put into a book, and there are some juicy stories in there and some cute pics. And I'm currently trying to get Bon Jovi to approve putting a photo of me standing with him in the book, which means that Bon Jovi's PR person has my manuscript because she was like, we need to see the manuscript first. So like right now at this moment, the manuscript for my book, Math Therapy, is in the hands of Bon Jovi's PR person.
That is like a huge life win right there.
Maybe he'll throw a blurb on it. Well, maybe he'll be like, wow, this book is halfway there.
Yeah. Anyone who knows? That? No. Follow her on The Math Guru. Listen to the Math Therapy podcast. And when the book comes out, you'll have to grab it. But thank you so much for joining me. I cannot wait to see you this summer.